in law, we deserve better. Lawyers deserve to have better tools for doing their work so that you can spend less time doing the manual, repetitious things, and more time on the sexy, interesting side of things, you know, where you're doing the analysis, you're thinking about the strategy, you're coming up with a more persuasive way of putting an argument. And I mean, that's the side of things that is fun, enjoyable, that the clients appreciate, and adds value to the case. So the more you can claw back time through automation of the repetitive tasks, the more that you can really put your time and energy into the analysis and advocacy that helps you to boost outcomes for your clients.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Better Law Firm Marketing Podcast. Now, this is a world first. I'm actually doing my intro basically live. I've got Ashley on Zoom with me, patiently waiting for me to finish up. So I'm just going to quickly introduce him. His name's Ashley Kelso. Yes, he is my brother. He's my older brother. He's also a solicitor and the founder of the legal tech startup Law Light, which we'll be talking about more soon. Now, in today's episode, we're going to talk a bit about Ashley's journey to how he got to where he is today, including, you know, it hasn't always been easy for Ashley. He's got quite a remarkable work ethic. So he's had to battle with ADD and a neurological disorder, which I also have, which we'll talk about soon as well. And he'll talk about Law Light and basically anything else that pops up really. And I've included some links in the description so you can learn more about Ashley. Now, quickly, before we dive in, please check out please consider checking out the episode notes. I've got some useful information and links there. So if you want to get a free law firm marketing plan, there's a link there for that. And there's also a coaching call. So if you want to apply for one of those, there's a link there as well. And those will take you to the Legal Sites website, which I'll tell you about soon. And there's some affiliate links for products and services that I use as well. So that means that I'll get a small payment if you do click on those and use any of those. So some of the links include if you want to build a WordPress website, if you want to host that website, if you even want to start your own podcast as well. So check out those if you'd like. And I've partnered up with an Australian website called Firm Checker, and they essentially are helping lawyers get more clients online. If you want to learn more about those, learn more about Firm Checker, there's a link in the description and there is a discount code that you can use as well. Now, please also consider leaving a 5-star review and subscribing. Apparently it helps with the algorithm, and maybe tell a friend about the podcast as well. All that stuff helps. And if you've got ideas for future episodes, if there are guests you want me to bring onto the podcast, for example, or if there are things you want me to talk about, then just get in touch with me through legalsites.com.au. And finally, I just want to introduce myself properly. I'm your host, Brennan Kelso, a law grad turned law firm marketing specialist, founder of legalsites.com.au. And you're listening to the Better Law Firm Marketing Podcast. And in this podcast, you'll learn how to leverage the most time-efficient law firm marketing strategies to get more leads, more clients, and more profit. And today, you're going to learn a little bit more about Law Light as well and some legal tech stuff. So that's enough of that. Let's just get on with it. So thanks for waiting patiently there, Ashley.
I did do a very good job.
Thank you. I was reading off my Google documents, so there's no way in hell I memorized all of that.
I couldn't tell. So. No.
Definitely the listeners out there won't know, but those who are brave enough to watch us on YouTube might be able to see that. But Ash, I've got a bit of an idea about your journey. I've been there for a fair bit of it, but there's a lot of people out there who probably don't know a lot about how you got to where you are today. So if it's all good, I wouldn't mind sort of starting, I don't know, around when you're a bit younger, maybe around the time you started kindergarten, and just sort of walk us through your time at school and your ADD and the CMT and a few of the other things you've had to overcome to get to where you are now.
Sure. So I think I always envied yourself and our sister Lydia that you just had this ability to dive in, do the work, and then go and do the next thing. Whereas with ADD, it's like constantly having someone every 30 seconds come up to you and interrupt you and say, hey, here's this other slightly more interesting thing that you could be doing instead of this thing that you're supposed to be doing. Let's go do that. And you're like, yeah, all right. And then, wait a minute, I'm supposed to be doing this thing. And then having that happen over and over and over again. I think in the long run, it helped me to hone a discipline, because you've got this double-edged sword with ADD, is that you'll have a higher level of creativity, and there's even been papers on this, that you're more innovative because you see things differently. You see all the tangents because your brain shoots off on all the tangents, and you have a tendency to go and do deep dives into all sorts of different things. So you can see a problem from so many different perspectives, but then you need the follow-through, because you don't get any prizes for half-finished projects, you know, half-finished degrees, half-finished, you know, businesses and things like that. So you have to develop this discipline, and you have to develop a lot of systems to remind yourself and stay on track. And so, yeah, I didn't have an easy run with school, because school requires you to sit still and to listen. And I'll be listening, and then I'll hear something, and that'll shoot my mind off in another direction. I'll be thinking about that, and then realize that the school bell rings, and I didn't hear anything that was said. I was thinking about something else.
I know that's a long time ago, but do you remember when you were told that you have ADD?
I remember being sat down in kindergarten with the teacher and my parents, and they were discussing whether to repeat me in kindergarten, and I didn't want to, for, you know, you feel like, well, all your friends are going to be, you know, going to the next year and you're not. And so they didn't, but then in year one they did. And I think it sort of came about, I don't really remember necessarily some of the testing. I remember that I did some, I was part of a study that they did that, locally on ADD as well, for some research. I think it sort of clicked for mum, because she did medicine, but she also was a bit ahead of her time in that she took an elective during her medical degree, which covered ADD and other conditions like that, back when it wasn't as known a thing. And so she was aware of it, and she was thinking, well, what's going on? Like, my son, who's, you know, in primary school, can beat me in chess, but he's failing at school. So he seems to have intelligence. And then I tested quite well when they did my IQ as a kid as part of this research project. But yet I wasn't doing well at school. So, well, what's going on there? But I ended up on Dex first, which sort of wiped my personality out. So they put me on Ritalin, and then it was like, okay, now this is a bit better.
Do you remember the first time you popped the Ritalin?
Okay. I do. I remember the first night. So you've never had amphetamine.
Of course you do, because you didn't sleep much.
Didn't sleep.
Yeah.
No, I'm just a kid, and I think it was just a 10 milligram Ritalin, and I was up till about midnight. You know, I had trouble sleeping as it was. I've always been a night owl, even as a kid. I always hated going to bed because it took a long time to get to sleep. But yeah, I was up till about midnight before I could get it to sleep. It got used to it after that, and it made a difference, because I went from failing kindergarten and year one to getting straight A's in year two. So it was a fairly significant difference. And I don't need much of the medication to get the result. So it tends to confirm it, I think.
So are you still?
Yeah, I am. So it's sort
still
of,
sort you're
of
still near. Enhanced.
Still enhanced. Still juicing. the thing is, it can be very frustrating again with ADD. You've got to have a lot of discipline, and it can wear you down. And if you're tired, it's harder. So you sort of need it to be able to have that mental endurance to follow through on the things you need to do. You know, you have to use a lot more self-control than other people do to get through things. And if you're tired, or, you know, you're working hard on something, or you've just got to get something done that's not inherently interesting, it might be painfully boring to do, but you've got to do it. You'll burn through that you know, self-control so much faster. And so the Ritalin helps you to go the distance that other people can do without that level of effort. So you can you know, make your life work.
Wow. And then you did fairly well at school, and I recall you having just an amazing work ethic, especially during your HSC. And talk about the math that you did, the 4-unit math, and you had some other people in your class as well that were pretty good as well, but you seem to outperform Did you come first in full unit or close? Or
I did. Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess the start of that was back in year nine. And I saw you actually start to study for your end of year exams a couple of weeks out. And I'd never done that before. And I thought, oh, maybe I'll just give that a go too, you know, like actually study for the exams. And then I think I topped one of my subjects. I can't remember which one. I mean, it might have somehow fluked English. I was very facetious in the way I wrote the paper, and they took me seriously and gave me a good mark. And I was like, what? And I thought, well, maybe I should do that again. And so I got some pretty good placings. And I noticed that with maths, I could get in the top five without having to work that hard at it. So then I thought, well, let's really go for this. And then it came year 11 and 12, and I just thought, I'm going to do the four unit, you know, the school decided that they would run it because another family forced them to and said they would leave and go to another school if they didn't let their very smart kids do this subject. And I just said, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to come first, and I'm just going to outwork everybody else until I do. And I would take a different approach of studying too, rather than, and it's followed me through the whole way, like to this day still, is I'm not kind of rote learn all the formulas. You can rote learn 20, 30 formulas, or you can actually understand how the formulas are derived and then derive from first principles. And so I try to do that, is understand everything down to the ground so that I can then, you know, build it back up again. So I think that the more you understand, the less you have to remember when it comes to that sort of thing. Mm. So, yeah, I just worked and worked and worked at it, and I'd be up to midnight most nights. You know,
what was
studying and cracking the problems?
Like, why were you doing? Why were you working your butt off on four unit math and these other subjects when you didn't have to do this?
Well, I think I wanted to, I wanted to have options in my future, and I think you've got to put the work in if you want to have choices and you want to have options and be able to do things down the path. And so I think the harder you work now, the more, options you've got later on. Whereas if you don't put the work in now, you don't get that time back. Yeah. And I'm the kind of person where I think I'd rather sort of, do absolutely everything that I possibly could have to make a situation succeed, so that if it doesn't, at least I have peace to know that there's nothing more I could have done. There's no certainty in life. You've just got to do everything you can to increase the chances that it will actually succeed.
I think that's one of the things that often. Oh, sorry. Did you know you wanted to do engineering at that point in your life?
I didn't. I just knew I was good with math. I was good at working out the patterns in things, what essentially the algorithms are for things. So sometimes I could actually learn an area of math without really necessarily understanding what it was supposed to be about, but I could work out all the patterns that, when you see this, then you do this and then you get that. And so I didn't actually do physics at school, but then I had to, my first physics course was in engineering. I had to do advanced physics too. So so I went from doing no physics at school to now do, quantum mechanics. So that was hard, vertical learning curve. But I just wanted to have options.
No big deal,
and
hey.
I saw math as something where, if you put the work in, there's no interpretation there. It's not like English where you have to sort of work out what your teacher, likes and what they don't like. You're either right or you're wrong. Three and four unit.
The pinnacle, was that as far as you could go at that point, or is there some other impossible course you could be doing?
that was it. As far as mathematics went, that's you can't go any further than that, and they don't actually make you sit the test for two units. So I think I was on track to get that one as well, but they just assume that you probably understand that. They don't test you for that measure, so they just do three and four unit. Out of that, I thought, well, I'm kind of match fit. If anything depends on math, I know I can do it. And there was an engineering lecturer in our street, Phil Clausen, Dr. Phil. He was suggesting engineering to me, and mean, if I had my time over, I probably would have gone into, you know, computer science or software engineering, but it just wasn't something that was on my radar at the time. You know, it was a different time then. It wasn't as clear back then where the trends were heading. But I got to do some programming as part of mechatronics. So that was good. It introduced me to that.
Yeah. So you worked hard through high school. You got a decent UAI. It wasn't ATAR back then. I think it was UAI. And then you got into mechanical and electronic engineering, mechatronics.
Mechatronics, it's real hybrid.
And then worked your way through that. That wasn't easy either. And then maybe talk a little bit about your what happened after you graduated.
Yeah, so I had the good fortune of when I graduated, then I joined defense, and I was really lucky with my first manager in DMO, Defense Material Organization, which has now just been absorbed back into Department of Defense as an organization. But he'd gone through this same graduate scheme I'd been through, and he'd had some experiences that he very felt like he could have been treated I think better in terms of the quality of work that he was given. So he didn't want to do that to me or to the other grad that was under him. And his name was Matthew. Gosh, he was a very smart guy. He did computer science and mechatronics as a double degree, and surprisingly chill about it. Yeah he's very smart. Matthew Turnbull was his name. He's a very bright guy. Yeah. So I was very fortunate. I learned a lot from him. Ryan Adam was his name. A very smart guy. Just also about how to navigate bureaucracies. He just understood it. Like, he could see the matrix of how to navigate inherently inefficient bureaucracies and get stuff done. And that really filtered through into how I'd approach things with law when I had to deal with government organizations, how to get things done with that. But it was funny, you'd be out to do inspect a project, and he'd have the chief engineer calling him up and saying, look, I don't really want you out there. I don't think we should be doing this. He's like, well, I'm getting off the plane now. So, I'm in Cairns and you're in Sydney. And that was that. So, he was very good at getting things done. But then I had some other placements on the program that weren't so good. And then I just really needed to get out of defense. I could just feel like what had happened was...
He's having a water break, everyone.
Yeah. What had happened was that the GFC hit, and we had a problem then because no one above me wanted to get promoted, and they didn't want to have to learn new things. So you sort of, well, what are my options? And we also had a hiring freeze. So I was basically faced with the choice of I either just sit here and learn nothing further, because no one wants to teach you how to do their job lest you try to get promoted, and they don't want that. So I just sit here and just hope that the seasons change. And you couldn't get out in the private industry because all the capital had dried up. There was no money for big engineering projects, and the mining boom was getting hit and getting knocked over. But I realized that I was good at communicating better than most engineers were, and that was where so many of the projects in defense were having problems, was just engineers being able to communicate as that conduit between the user and the decision makers. And I was able to translate, technical to non-technical for people. Is it, when you're mechatronics, you get kind of used to having to flip between lots of different disciplines, and you become comfortable with that. And so I thought, well, the engineers aren't the ones getting to make the decisions in an organization. It's often the people with the law and business backgrounds. So if you can't beat them, join them. I thought, well, I'll may as well jump out and learn while this whole GFC thing is working itself out, so that I can, I can have more skills when I come out the other side of that. So that was my thinking there.
Wow. And then you started law. So
yeah,
walk us through.
I must love punishment.
Is there anything else out there that you should be like? When's the medical degree gonna? When's that happening?
Oh, I don't know if I could. I think it requires too much Too much memorization. I don't know.
I thought you were going to say empathy or something like that.
Yes, poor mum. None of us went into the caring professions.
Empathy and patience. And I don't mean the actual patients themselves. I mean the patients. So you did law. You did it by correspondence through Armidale.
I did. It's a good university.
How did you feel once you started doing law? Did you feel like you'd sort of found your thing, or did that not quite happen straight away?
I think I'm often sort of in search of my thing, and I think it's kind of the way life is that, you know, what you want and what you're interested in sort of changes and evolves along the way. And I think it's one of those overarching things that you think when you're young that you've got to sort of know what your passion is and follow that, but I think it's something that you work out. It's some things you just can't know by thinking. You have to sort of trial and error and see what fits right. But I felt like, you know, it was fitting well. I found it very interesting. I like to sort of think through and understand, you know, very principled way, how a problem should be solved or why a certain rule is a certain way. And so I dove into that really, really hard, and I wanted to, do a really good job of it. I thought people are going to be relying on the advice that I would give. I want to do the best that I can. I never want, you know, a client to have a less than the best result they could get because I hadn't, you know, worked as hard as I possibly could. So that would keep me. I would push through when I was tired to make sure I did all the readings and took all the notes and did it as well as I could. And so I found it interesting. It was good to sort of round out the skill set from, you know, knowing how things work to knowing how, you know, systems, you know, with people and societies work in that sense, to understand how the rules work. And it's funny, the first thing that hits you when you start studying law is, you probably realize too, is that a lot of what you've been told by people up to that point is BS.
I still feel that way.
Yeah, people are always trying to put things over you, you know, beforehand, aren't they? It's just like, oh, no, that's, the law is this. And it's like,
oh, yeah.
What? Yeah. No, it's not. Someone told me on an internet page, or I read it on Facebook, you know.
Yeah, I think... more than, but I think these days I do fact check things. I'm very like suspect on like information, and I do want to double check a lot of things. And I don't know, I was watching that new TV show with Maddie the other night, my partner, about Dr. Death, Dr. Dunch. And I don't know, have you seen it?
I don't think I have.
No, it's on Stan. It's really quite good. And essentially, like, he was, a doctor who hurt a lot of people. So he was a neurospinal surgeon. I don't know what you call them, but he was operating on people's spines and necks and all of that. Mm. And a few people died, and a lot of them were permanently injured and incapacitated. One of them was a quadriplegic, and it was very unclear whether or not he was intentionally hurting people, or if he was poorly trained, or if he had some sort of mental illness, or a combination of things. No one really knows, but I don't want to ruin anything, but essentially, like, the sentence that he received, I thought was like, I was like, wow, like, I don't know, like, that seems like a lot for the charge that he got. But like, yeah, so I do. And I was like, is that really?
Is it an American one or something? Was it like seven consecutive life sentences?
Well, I don't want to ruin it for anyone who hasn't seen the show, but yeah, it's in Texas, and the charge was for elder abuse, and it was just like, it was amazing. But back to your point, I'm quite a critical thinker now. I like to think that I am, and I think law school and uni can really teach you to really just check a lot of stuff to see if it's actually true, because a lot of people will just say, oh, yeah, apparently, you know, this is the law, or apparently, so, you know, and it's like, no, let's Google it. Like, a lot of things are not actually true, but people just say them because if someone else has told them that, they think that must be true, and then they just end up repeating it, and it just kind of keeps cycling. So,
the anecdote gains legitimacy through repetition, doesn't it, in that way?
It's just, yeah. It absolutely does. And I think maybe, you know, this can be a bit irritating for some people. Like, it, maybe I'd be, maybe I should just go, yeah, I'm sure that's true, rather than Googling something and proving someone wrong in front of a group of people. Maybe that's not the way to make friends, but hey. But you did your law degree, and I hope you don't mind asking, but I know you did practice for a few years as a lawyer, but I wouldn't mind if you talked a bit about your aspirations to be a barrister and what happened there, and you know, what you've learned as a result.
Yeah. So I always have enjoyed, you know, sort of the philosophical aspects of law and the argument, the persuasion. I think because I'm naturally more of an introvert, but I could see from a young age that you've got to be able to communicate in order to get anywhere. You know, it's like I often noticed with engineers went into engineering because English and communication is not their strong suit, and then they find that they can't get their projects up and they can't get things done unless they can communicate what they're trying to do to non-technical decision makers. And then, you know, it's like how lawyers go into law many times because, you know, math isn't their strong suit, and then they end up, if they do something like personal injury, there's quite a bit of math that you need to be able to do to get your claims done. Sorry, I lost my train of thought.
Yeah, there. Barrister. So
barrister, you
studied for the bar, and I'd really like, I think it'd be a good time to talk about the neurological disorder, Charcot-Marie-Tooth syndrome.
Both have
the CMT. So, tell people what happened there, because you are, you know, you
it was very frustrating.
You didn't get didn't get the allowances that maybe you should receive as someone with a disability.
No, it's quite crushing in a way. So I'm used to being able to use technology to sort of work around disabilities that I have to deal with. So CMT is a problem for me, especially in my hands. And it's gotten a bit worse over time. I mean, I would have the situation throughout my law degree where towards the end of each semester, my hands would just pack it in. Like you try to type and your fingers are hitting the keyboard inaccurately and working slower than you're telling them to work. And I had to use dictation software to do some of my exams because my hands were just stuffed.
How would you describe CMT to someone who's never heard of it?
I think just you have those dreams where, you know, you feel like you're trying to move, but you're weak.
Yeah,
you're trying to, you know, fight something, but you haven't got the strength in your body that you usually would.
I have dreams where I'm trying to punch someone, but it doesn't hurt them. I don't know why.
It's very frustrating.
Something a little bit bizarre about that dream. But so it's to do with the myelin sheath and the basically the signals from your brain to your hands and your feet are weak
and delayed
and causes weakness in the hands and feet primarily, and deformities as well, especially in my feet. So you were studying for the bar exam, and they didn't give you extra time, and you had to write everything down on pen and paper, and that was just not very fair, was it?
Yeah, well, I had asked, you know, can I at least, you know, type it, because if I've got to write by hand, like my handwriting has been illegible since forever. You know, when you're the son of a lawyer and a doctor, you haven't got much of a chance of legible handwriting to start with. But my hands just can't really do it. Like, I don't really write anything hardly by hand anymore, maybe a few scribbled notes, and I find myself having to rewrite it because I can't read what I've written. Handwriting's just not my thing. My hands will wear out fast, and so I prefer to type if I can, and then sometimes if I've got to write something really long, I'll use dictation software. And I'm not really used to sort of dictating something for someone else to, you know, to write out for me. I'm used to being able to, if I use something like Dragon, you know, I'll be speaking it, see it on the screen, and then I can go back and make changes and have that control over it. I think they gave me a little bit of extra time, but they refused to let me type it on computer, which is strange because the very next round were done by everyone on computer. But there you go. So I was in the exam. I'd worked hard, and I, you know, at that point, I think I had actually, I done court work. I did Court of Appeal solo, and came out on top with that. So I knew that I could do advocacy in court, at a reasonable level. But yeah, in the exam, my hands just packed it in. It really is like everybody else who doesn't have nerve damage in their hands is able to get the information on the page over a fiber optic cable, and I'm working with dial-up, basically. So I just can't get the data on the page from my head through my hands into the page at the same speed, and then it degrades. And I was getting just, you know, my hands were cramping up, and I was having to, you know, force my fingers back open and get them, you know, holding the pen again. Sharp pain shooting through my wrists, and I'm trying to write the exam. And then the way that you treat it is like, well, you know, I guess you just didn't know it if you didn't get it on the page. And it's like, it's very demeaning. I'm not used to thinking of myself as having disabilities, because I've kind of used technology and technique to work around them. But then when you hit put in a situation where you can't work around a disability that you've got, and you treat it as if, you know, a physical disability is an intellectual one. Mm. It's rather demeaning, and it really did hit me quite hard. It's very frustrating when you think, great, so, I have this disability. I have the intelligence to do this thing, but because my hands, you know, can't go the distance with this sort of thing, I'm kept out of that line of work.
It just doesn't sound right. And I don't know. I didn't realize that the test to become a barrister was how fast you could write with a pen and paper. You know, I thought it was, I thought there was a lot more to being a barrister than that. So you'd think that, they would have, allowed you to type, but so you had the information in your head, couldn't get it down on paper fast enough. But now they're allowing people to type their exams.
Yeah. It seemed, I understand it's all done on computer by everyone. So,
yeah, right.
So the thing I've always faced with, you know, people don't like giving someone special provisions in exams, even when you've got letters from a neurologist or something to say.
Especially if you look at your hands, objectively you think your hands look fine, but they're not. So you've got evidence from a doctor explaining the condition. But hey, it is what it is. But you know, if you were taking the exam under the conditions now, you'd most likely perform incredibly well. But it sounds like it was all for the best. We've talked a lot about, how you've got to where you are today, and from the ADD and engineering and performing well at school and outperforming other people who are very gifted. And you've definitely got sufficient education, I think, behind you now. And you've proved to everyone that you can definitely put your head down and get something done, and something that's not easy either. So that's admirable. And maybe it'd be a great time to kind of talk about the inception of your startup Lawlight, sort of why you created it and what how you're helping people.
Yeah,
And what Lawlight is, why someone would be interested in Lawlight.
Yeah, of course. I mean, in a nutshell, Lawlight, the concept is to develop essentially an engine room for case preparation. So it was born out of a bunch of things. And I suppose it's one of these things that at the time when you've got to switch between disciplines or change jobs or go into a different industry, and you feel like you worked so hard and now you just got to throw it away and start again. But nothing's wasted. It sort of comes back again. And so I guess the origin of it came for me when coming from engineering, we have, 100 plus years of disciplined approach to how you run projects, how you manage your work, how you coordinate as a team to get something complicated done. And coming into law, it just doesn't seem to be So it doesn't seem to exist. It's one of these interesting things when you're multidisciplinary, you often find that there'll be one discipline has a problem and then another discipline has a very mature, developed solution to that kind of problem. And it's about mapping over into the other discipline those lessons from the other one so that you can solve those problems. And so coming into law and then seeing how legal practices manage their work and having, you know, training in project management and systems engineering, I started to apply, you know, those tools and those methods to how I'd manage the legal work, and then how I would help, you know, others around me work together more effectively as a team, you know, getting the right people in the right seats doing the tasks that they need to be doing, planning out the procedure like a production line from start to finish, you know, what tasks need to be done to get to the output we need. You know, we need this outcome on this case. What's everything that's going to go into that? Who needs to be doing that? At what stages? Start to finish, and to have, you know, procedures, have pre-made decisions so that people aren't having to, you know, start afresh every time and make it work more smoothly. It was amazing the results that could be achieved. I remember we had at the firm, we were used to doing maybe preparing 130, you know, victims comp claims in a month as the best that people thought that we could do. And then all of a sudden 500 got listed for the next month and people were freaking out and, you know, can we defer things? And I thought, oh, I reckon there's a bit of inefficiency here that we can do this. And so reordered the way that we did the work and we did it. It's about a 300%+ increase in efficiency. And in that space, we actually lost one or two people as well. So with a reducing team, we actually got more work done. And then it filtered through into doing more personal injury cases. That was a bit of a baptism of fire for me as well as a young solicitor not long out. We had a situation where I had to take over managing other people and teaching them how to do it and running the cases. And I just had to be able to learn, be good at learning quick and teaching. And it's one of the things that you have to be able to do if you're going to do something like mechatronics is you get good at doing a deep dive, being thrown, kicking and screaming to the deep end and having to get your head around something fast and then get a result. And so I guess I had that faith in myself that I could do that sort of thing, and I did. But it was very hard, but we got there. But I would build in procedures, I would systematize how we did things, make it clear what people needed to do, have ability for us to coordinate more effectively. And I also found that as I'm getting along to the settlement conferences, you know, everything's being done manually and by hand, running numbers, calculating damages, all being done by hand and calculator. And as many personal injury lawyers will know, is that calculating damages is kind of a bit of art and science. It's not just like a, you know, repairing your car. You know, there's just a list of things and this is what they cost depending on where you go. But with damages, you know, because life is uncertain, you have to be able to sort of adjust things and you know, tweak things and come out with numbers that look about right, but that you can justify well. And so by automating those calculations, you could do that better. And so that sort of, you know, was the beginning of one of the tools that we've ended up building for Lawlight, which is a damages calculator. And there are other implementations of this, but it's another area where legal tech, I feel, has not been where it should be for the industry. This is another driving factor for me with Lawlight, is I feel that the legal industry deserves better. You know, I look at engineering and the tools that we have are not just about organizing your files. They're also about helping you leverage technology to get through the tasks that are involved in doing your work as well. You know, we don't just have something like GitHub for version control or Atlassian for, with Jira for managing all your different tasks. You've actually got, you know, software for doing the calculations. You know, like civil engineers will have things like Cloud Civ and AutoCAD and Autodesk and that sort of thing for actually doing the calculations. They're not sitting there with a slide ruler doing it by hand. And I just felt that In law, we deserve better. Lawyers deserve to have better tools for doing their work so that you can spend less time doing the manual, repetitious things and more time on the sexy, interesting side of things, you know, where you're doing the analysis, you're thinking about the strategy, you're coming up with a more persuasive way of putting an argument. And I mean, that's the side of things that is fun, enjoyable, that the clients appreciate. And adds value to the case. So the more you can claw back time through automation of the repetitive tasks, the more that you can really put your time and energy into the analysis and advocacy that helps you to boost outcomes for your clients. And so I would start to build these things up because I can code. I'd write some things up in Excel. I'd write some things up in Python, where I learned that I went and did a stint with the Sydney Machine Learning Meetup, which was really great. They got in some data scientists and we all went through Harvard's data science 101 course and built a project and learned, you know, Python and learned the data science libraries, and I brought that in. And so it sort of come from that. It's feeling like the legal industry deserves better. You know, we pay through the nose for software that doesn't help us with so much of our job, that requires a training day just to get started, that by the time the training day is over, everyone's forgotten what they covered. And then by the time they come to using some of the additional functions in that software, we can't remember how to use it. And so it doesn't get used. We pay so much for it and then it's not intuitive. So, and yet over on other industries like engineering and software development, there's really affordable tools that really do help you get through your work and that you don't need a training day to get started on. So that's sort of where it's coming from for Lawlight. So just and it's sort of at the moment, there's sort of a core three tools. We wanted to build this in modules so that we could show credibility, that we're not just someone talking about an app. You know, we're building this. And here's the first piece, and then here's the second piece, and they're all self-contained and will, you know, deliver value on their own, but the value they deliver is multiplied when used together. And just doing that block by block. So we've done the damages calculator, and I think it's really, really good tool. I mean, it just makes the task so much easier to do, and you can do it to a higher level. Then we've just a bit tired today because I was up, you know, I've been up quite a few late nights recently getting the next one done, and we just finished it last night and launched it into beta so it can be used now via our site, which is the economic loss analyzer. And so what this lets you do is, you know, at the moment, right, if you want to actually calculate the economic loss in the claim that you're doing, whether you're a defendant or a plaintiff, you know, often you're having to brief a forensic accountant or an actuary, you know, and you're having to guess at what the right scenarios are that you should run. Take an educated guess, of course, on the evidence that you've got. But to get the numbers back properly, you've got to get a report done for thousands of dollars, and then maybe you've got to make changes because maybe there was a miscommunication between you and the expert. Whereas what we enable you to do is we've automated all these calculations. We've automated using the average weekly earnings. We've automated doing income projections, calculating super, calculating tax. And we can do it going back about 60 years so that you can use it for the historical claims as well. I know there's a lot of those going through. And you can do it visually. So lawyers aren't having to do math. They're not held back by having to get out the calculator. They're not having to do, you know, sums in their head or on the screen. And we show the effect of all the different scenarios you want to run visually on the screen. You can see the two lines. You can see a comparison earnings, you know, what the plaintiff would have earned had the injury not happened. And then you can see the claimant's actual earnings. You can upload your own earnings data set that you can pull out of your ATO records. And then if you're missing data, it'll estimate for the gaps. And then you can calculate, you know, what's the difference between the two lines, as opposed to being faced with a wall of numbers. Here it is, easy to use. And then you can auto-generate a report. So that's I think, going to be a real game changer for people as they pick it up and realize what they can do with this. It's significant. You know, it does basically what you'd pay, you know, $2,000 upwards to someone else to do, but you could do it yourself in 10 minutes with this tool.
Amazing. So if someone wanted to try it out, what do they do?
Just go to our website, lawlight.io, and just go up to the top right-hand corner, click on sign up, and just create your account, and then you're off and running. And so it's free to use while we're in beta, and we're taking a patient approach with that, because we really care about making sure that we are listening very carefully to people and their feedback, to make sure that this is as intuitive as possible for people to just pick up and hit the ground running with and get real value out of it. We don't want to build things for the ivory tower. You know, we want to build stuff that's affordable and for the everyday practitioner to use every day to make their life easier and help them punch above their weight, basically.
Perfect.
I should say that was part of the motivator for me too, is I was routinely having to go up against top tier firms, and I didn't have the resources of top tier firms. And I'd also, you know, I wanted to be careful about the amount of time and cost that was going to be to the client, because I often felt like, well, they were the ones that went through this horrible thing. I wanted to control, you know, what we're having to charge a bit, to do the work as efficiently as I could to get them the results, get them the best outcome that I could. I thought, you know, many cases it was their last opportunity to get back some of what was taken from them, and I wanted to get the best possible outcome for them that I could. So how do you punch above your weight? You know, I guess an engineer goes straight to technology. Yeah.
Well, thanks for sharing so much with us, Ashley. I know maybe it's not easy talking about some of your past hardships, but you know, I think it's all been for the best, and it's got you to where you are, where you're helping people and you're using your unique skill set, and I think it's exciting. So yeah, thank you. Thanks for being honest with me and everyone who's listening.
Yeah, I think many times you see someone who's managed to achieve something and you think that just came out of nowhere. But I think, you know, it's like that proverb, isn't it? You know, a prophet's never honored in his own town. It's because they saw your mistakes and they understood where you came from. Mm. People want to sort of believe that you just came out of nowhere. But I think most people who are achieving anything or doing anything that's a bit you know, different or special, well, you had to go through a lot of trial and error. You know, you have to make a lot of mistakes. And I think it's one of the things that just engineering, I constantly think, it kind of selects for, is people who have an ability to persist in the face of, you know, a level of repeated failure and confusion and frustration that would land most people in a psychiatrist's office. I remember in third year was very hard, and some guys would having meltdowns with the stress and frustration of it, but you really learn to keep going. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, look, there's a lot of bullshit out there, I think, especially on LinkedIn. So it's very easy to log in and think everyone's getting an award, everyone's getting a promotion, everyone's honored and humbled. And, you know, and I think it's just good that you've been real with us today. And, you know, maybe talked about some things that you haven't spoken about publicly before. And just anyone listening, I did ask Ashley about that before we hit the record button. So it's not like I bombarded him with questions. So, thanks for keeping it real, Ash. And I haven't had an easy run either throughout my life. And, you know, it's good to hear people talk about, you know, the ups and downs, because I think that's important. So before we wrap it up, you know, the kids might be getting back from the park soon, so that could we'd definitely hear all about that if they came in. So I look forward to seeing them again soon. But do you have anything, any sort of final words that you want to let the listeners know?
I invite you to get onto our site and check out what we've built, because I think it's really going to make a big difference for you. It's going to let you spend so much more of your time doing the aspects of the work that you actually enjoy, it's going to let you do that work to a level that previously might have seemed uneconomical to do, and give you, put the power back in your hands to do it. You know, you don't have to fire off email, some instructions or a commissioning letter, and then get back something and then, you know, understand what's been written. You can do the analysis yourself. We're also working on another app as well. It will tie it all together, that we're calling a case builder, that will help you with processing and managing and analyzing all the evidence that then gets fed into. There's other aspects of case preparation, managing your briefs and your bundles and things like that. So we're really trying to go after all the bottlenecks in practice for you. But we want to do things differently. So get in contact with us, talk to us, give us feedback, and we'll listen, and we'll, you know, we'll build in features that you want. But yeah, try us out and let us know what you think, and let's go on the journey together.
Sounds perfect. Well, I'll just quickly wrap up. So thank you so much, Ashley, for your time. And to all those listening, if you want to learn more about Lawlight, more about Ashley, then I'll include links in the description. There'll be a link to Lawlight, and I'll include a link to Ashley's LinkedIn page as well, so you can go and you know, connect with him personally and have a chat if you'd like. And just a reminder, of course, there are some more links in the description. So there's the free law firm marketing plan. There's a coaching call that you can apply for if you want to have one-on-one help with me. There's some affiliate links for products and services that I use. And there's also the discount code with Firm Checker. And if you do want to support the podcast as well, please consider leaving a 5-star review and subscribing. Maybe tell a friend about the podcast, or tell all your friends if you want. And if you've got ideas for future episodes, please don't hesitate to get in touch. So yeah, until next time, I'm Brendan Kelso, and you've been listening to Better Law Firm Marketing. Okay. All right. Bye for now.